Welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. And we've got another exciting episode.
Absolutely.
And you brought some research, and it's actually a paper on research, or it's a research on research?
Well, I'm going to tell you a story about research.
Okay. But before we get to that, you know, when you're in the world of recovery, and we've talked about it before, we've actually done whole episodes on them, on stupid memes in recovery that aren't actually stupid.
Yeah, you seem to be a fan. I get my memes through you.
Like one that's very popular in recovery is, if nothing changes, nothing changes.
Yeah.
Which sounds stupid.
It might be a typo.
But it's really true. Yeah. If nothing changes, then nothing changes.
You cannot deny the truth of that.
And then another one is the definition of insanity. Doing things over and over again, expecting a different outcome.
Yep, that's classic.
But that is so important when it comes to the world of recovery, because there's so many times you're in your active addiction and you'll get sober and you'll be like, hey, I got to figure it out this time. And then you don't do anything different.
Right.
And you find yourself again broken and rock bottom.
So in the stages of change, you might be bumping back and forth between pre-contemplation and contemplation.
Yeah.
But you're definitely not to action.
Yeah, you're not to action. And so you don't really do anything different. Another one that's big, because I follow a lot of like recovery pages on Instagram and Facebook, and that's where I get my news. The one that's really going around right now is hurt people, hurt people.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds...
Wait. Could we just repeat something and make it sound like intelligent?
Well, no, but I think if it's
to be the theme here.
I know, but I think if what you do is if you boil it down to its essence, that it's so true. It sounds corny. It sounds just something that you would hear.
But it is a very basic truth. And
yeah.
You're right.
And so
it's also a play on words there.
In the world of recovery, how many people have sat in this chair right here and got into their addiction or stayed in their addiction because of trauma, because they're hurt? You know what I mean?
I actually don't know the percentage out there in the world, but on our show, it's been really high.
And so what do they do in turn? They hurt other people because they're hurt. And so it's just this vicious cycle. And now re-emphasizes that addiction is not just a singular disease. It's a family disease.
That's true.
You know?
Absolutely.
And so, but the one I saw today.
Everybody suffers with it.
And I was going through my stories.
Oh, there's another meme coming?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm excited.
So I was going through this. And this one really hit me today. And it made me think. And I was going through my stories.
Your stories?
Well, no, you watch stories. It's Instagram.
And
stories, Dr. Matt, are the little circles up above the Instagram page. And so if you click on them.
Yeah, I have a hard time wanting to click on those.
It's 15 seconds of insight into these people's lives. And so you're checking
insight
out.
Might be generous, but okay.
Well, I found one from my good friend Blake Redd.
Okay, Blake, I bet his is good.
And it said, either you keep going or you quit. Both are going to hurt.
Was there more? Or was that the end of the story?
Okay. Well, at the end it says, read that again. But I didn't want to.
Yeah. 15 seconds is all you can manage.
Right? Yeah. And so, but it's so true.
So say it again. Say it again. Because I wasn't listening.
Either you keep going or you quit. Both are going to hurt.
Both are going to hurt. Okay. Yeah. I get that. But the implication is one leads to a good outcome and one doesn't.
But they're both going to hurt.
Yeah.
And so you've got to sit down, and that's when it comes back to
addiction.
Do you want
your pain to be productive?
Yes.
Or not productive?
You're the one that says resistance promotes growth.
I do say that.
And resistance.
Is that a meme?
No, it's not a meme yet.
How do I make it a meme?
I don't know.
Do I have to do a picture?
Did you say it twice?
I could. I think, I don't know the difference between a saying and a meme.
Well, a meme is, it's visual, bro.
So I have to find a picture.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to think of this. I'm going to make my own meme.
Okay.
I'm serious. I'm going to make a meme.
I'm with you.
I'm bringing it in.
Can we get back on point?
Yeah.
Either you keep going or you quit. Both is going to hurt. And how does that relate back to the recovery world?
Yeah, is that a quiz?
Because I'll tell you now. There's so many times when people come up to me and they want me to talk to their loved one. They want me to talk to somebody who's battling addiction. Yeah. And my answer is, do they want it?
Yeah.
If they don't want it, then it's not going to take.
Yeah.
And so they either have to keep going, and it seems like right now they're quitting. And so we've got to figure out a way to get them to keep going, because that's the only way through this.
I have a thought.
And
hopefully this is cool with Blake that I add to his meme.
Uh-huh. And now Blake's not in recovery. He's just a friend on my Instagram.
I think he's probably awesome, and it's a great meme.
Yeah.
And hopefully he's cool with me adding to it. So I would say the quitting pain also includes hopelessness. When you quit, you become hopeless. But the continuing pain, the not quitting, creates like optimism and positivity, hopefulness.
Yeah.
So one's going to carry you through and one's going to keep you discouraged, huh?
I like it.
Is that like a sec? Is there a meme 2.0? Can
yeah,
we do no, that?
Yeah, we, okay. You do whatever you got to do. I mean, there's a lot of times that I'm in the gym and the guy next to me will be like, feel the burn. Now, the burn's a good thing, bro.
Yeah.
Because that means you're pushing through. You want to feel the burn.
Okay. Is that a meme?
No.
Okay.
I didn't say it twice.
Yeah. It is. All right.
So, but I think that's...
It's good pain versus bad pain.
When it comes to addiction and recovery, and I get questions about it daily, and that's what I tell people, is you've got to want it, mm-hmm. and you want to keep pushing forward. And there's going to days you're going to want to quit.
What I love about this show is this show, every week, we have personal examples of that.
And people who have overcome some of the hugest obstacles ever, and now are living fruitful, wonderful, amazing lives. Yeah. And that's what this podcast does, is it focuses more on recovery than the addiction. Now, unfortunately, to get to recovery, you have to go through the addiction. But we want to show people that it's possible. And that's what this podcast is all about.
Definitely.
So your paper says what?
Oh, my turn?
Yeah.
Okay. It's not a meme. It's just research.
Okay.
Okay. So here's the story. I'm telling you a story about some research. Usually I come in, I tell you some research. It's usually negative about marijuana, and then somebody has a problem with it.
Now, do you think the majority of people out there, as soon as they hear the word research,
they tune out?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Why do you think that? Because research can be spun in so many different ways to prove whoever's point they want to.
No, because it's effortful to read it, and not everybody thinks that way. But we're going to make it fun right now. I'm going to tell you a story.
Right.
So this happened this morning, true story. One of the people that was going to come in and see me was a few minutes late. So I had a few minutes. I was looking through research topics. If one jumped out at me, I thought, oh, maybe I'll bring it on to the show today. And the title of this one was Cannabis and Schizophrenia, Implications in the Legalization Era. And it goes on to talk about how, very similar to one I read a few weeks ago, that 1 in 4 patients, so that's 25% mm-hmm. of people who have their first psychotic episode are also heavy marijuana users.
Yeah.
So that's a crazy correlation, okay? Then I was looking at that. I'm like, wow. And it references 11 other recent research articles that say similar things. Then my patient comes in late, and guess what? He had been using marijuana this recently, and it got laced with LSD. And he had this psychotic episode, and it was just a whole awful thing, and there's legal charges now. So we were talking about, you know, the drawbacks to using marijuana heavily. Then on the way over here, I was thinking, you know, I actually had the coolest message from somebody, a friend of mine from high school. I haven't talked to her since high school. And she had mentioned that she listens to the show, and that she appreciated that because that had been a similar experience with her son, who struggles with mental health. Specifically psychosis and marijuana use. And so I'm telling you these stories just to tell you, number one, I love hearing from people that listen to the show, especially somebody I've known from my past. And so I appreciate her taking the time to reach out and share that with me. She was just sharing.
Yeah.
That's all. But I also want you to know it is real that this connection between heavy marijuana use and psychosis, and we're learning more and more about it every day. I was thinking back to even just 2 years ago, I wouldn't have found 2 or 3 of these types of articles every week. I wouldn't have found one that had listed 11 other similar articles that have come out in the last 2 years. So my point is just that while we may be finding out that there are some helpful things about THC,
sure,
we also have to be careful that A, it's not always clean when you're buying it off the street. You really do need to be careful. At West High School, we had a young man die recently from a fentanyl overdose, and it had to do with his drug use. So we have to be careful. You need to educate people, especially teenagers, that there are some high risks by taking things off the street, whatever kind of drug it is, marijuana, pills, etc. The other thing is just to understand that everything has a risk. You know, you can make arguments for the fact that red wine and alcohol can be healthy for you, and they're legitimate. But we also, nobody denies all the health factors and risk factors that go along with heavy alcohol use. And so I want people to understand heavy marijuana use is not risk-free. So that's just the story. I didn't want to get into the article too much. It's just the amount of articles keep stacking up, and personal experiences that I'm having with people that are struggling with that keep stacking up, unfortunately. So I just wanted to get that word out.
No, and I think that's what is missing is so much as the full story or information. Information is key. And you can never have too much information. And so many times we find out that, you know, marijuana was the golden child of drugs for a while, where they were saying, hey, this will help you sleep, this will help your back, this will help your anxiety and all of this. Mm-hmm. But nobody ever explored the other side because they were so enamored with all the good things it's doing. And yeah, when Valentine's comes around, you're going to have the news stations. And I work for one come out and go, hey, dark chocolate is great for you. It's good for the heart. You know what I mean? And then everyone's going to jump on that and tell you all the good things. But too much dark chocolate's horrible for you. It's risk factors. And so you've got to be balanced and you've got to know both sides of it. And I think information that you bring is crucial.
And I'm going to challenge listeners, if this talking about this has bothered you, ask yourself, do I process information emotionally or rationally? That's a really important thing to know about ourselves. We all do both, but when you hear something you don't like, do your emotions take over and close your ears off to hearing new information? If it might, then you might want to rethink, like, oh, what's that about me? Why do I get defensive?
Well, I think recently in the past 10 years, news has been delivered emotionally. And not rationally.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's why when you said, you know, you got this research, most people think, is he just spinning this for his own gains or his own insight?
Yeah, social media is just the example of our day of that, right?
Yeah. So I appreciate it and I like it. And I think that's a good challenge for everybody out there.
Yeah. Think about it. Like you asked me, why do I like research? Because it allows me not to be emotional. It allows me to contemplate and think like, okay, what is this data trying to say to me? And I'm not going to let somebody else disseminate it to me because they might be spinning it like you're saying.
If somebody's a research head like you are, is there like a place to go? I know you always mention some book.
Well, the easiest thing would be you can do scholarly articles on Google. And so there is a button where you switch from regular Google to scholarly articles. I can't say that apparently. And you can find links to real research that way. Most libraries also have free access to research articles online as well. But you could start with the Google Scholar articles, and I think that's a great place to start.
Josh, libraries are like Google, but it's like a brick and mortar store, and you go into it, and they have all the books and the information up on the walls. Yeah,
he looks confused. He just looks confused.
We've got a great show for you today. We've got a guy named Jared Casey. Notice how I didn't get his last name wrong.
Yeah, you did a good job.
Yeah.
I was a little worried.
No, I got that one right. And Jared Casey is a clinical director at a couple different places. But before we find out about that, how do we get you on our podcast? What brings you here?
I was invited by a good friend of mine, John Redd, to come talk with you and... He loves your podcast. He loves what you're doing. He believes in what your cause is and helping people get informed.
So do you have an addiction? Are you in recovery?
I'm not in recovery from your traditional means. I mean, I've struggled on and off with pornography addiction throughout my life, especially teenage years and early in my marriage. And it was pretty devastating in all aspects of relationships.
And how did you get in to be a clinical director? And for those who don't know, what is a clinical director?
So a clinical director is who kind of runs the program for addiction recovery programs like treatment centers and makes sure that it's clinically sound, making sure people are getting the right kind of care.
And so now you're one of those at two different places or no?
Yeah. So I started out as clinical director for I Am Recovery in Cedar Hills. And that's kind of my baby. I helped build that up for the last 7 years. Then I moved to Morgan for various reasons, mostly for family reasons. And I'm taking on an opportunity to be a clinical director for Reprieve Recovery now.
And that's the new one that just opened up in Morgan. It's an all-women's facility. Opened up just about a week ago. Currently, it's got about 2 clients. How many people can it house?
8.
8. And what's unique about having just 8?
Well, it's what we're approved for. That's one reason it's unique. But secondly, it's also a nice niche group. And you get to work with tight relationships and help people in a small setting.
I would think if you are the person that needs those services, being in a small cohort of 8 people would just be ideal.
It is ideal. As long as you can stay close to full. It's a little tougher to do a group with just 2 people.
And, you know, he says something about keeping full is because what you don't understand, and this is the problem that I have with the recovery community, and not just in Utah, all the way around, is that it is a business. mm-hmm. and it is helping people. And you've got to find that balance, because if you've got an empty house, you've still got to pay a therapist. You got to pay a clinical director. You got to pay a night staff. You got to pay a chef. You got to pay your house bill. You got to pay your electricity. And if nobody's there, how do you do that?
You go broke pretty fast, actually.
And so how do you, you know, and that's the dance. And, you know.
Do you want me to tell you the answer?
Yeah.
You pass laws to have government subsidized so that the government helps pay for these important services.
Now, right now, does insurance pay for some? And for some people it does, and some people it doesn't. I know the answer to
that. Yeah, it's a tricky balance, because insurance will pay for some. And if you have in-network contracts, typically they'll pay a little bit more consistently. If you don't have those contracts, it's not as consistent. So it's definitely juggling. And on the state side of things, there are state programs that pay, but usually pay insufficient to even cover the staff.
They're not sufficient. They're not good enough.
Or they funnel the money to the same players.
And the reason I'm saying that is not just to promote a socialist idea, but the idea is that when we reduce addiction in our communities, then we have more people that are available to work and rebuild and add to our communities. So we've seen time in, time out, people on this show doing such amazing things because they are clean and sober and in recovery. And I think that as a community, that would be a wonderful place for a lot of our resources to go, because those people give back just by whether they're running a nonprofit or they're just working a full-time job. Now they're paying taxes. Now they're a citizen who's giving back to the community. It pays back. And I don't think a lot of people understand that concept.
All right, let's go back to your story, Jared.
Casey doesn't want to talk about politics.
I do want to talk about politics. No,
I don't.
I'm not very good at it because I'm not smart. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's find out how Jared started his career in therapy and ended up becoming a clinical director. You're listening to Project Recovery. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. And our guest today, Jared Casey, clinical director at Reprieve Recovery, which is up in Morgan, just opened its door. A clinical director, what kind of initials do you have behind your name? What kind of schooling did you do?
So I went into school for marriage family therapy. So mm-hmm. LMFT is the fun initials I have.
And so you wanted to be a marriage and family therapist.
I did. I did want to be that. I wanted to be more of a systems-based thinker. So I like to work with families. Mm-hmm. And that was the best direction for that at the time. I initially started social work and I pivoted towards that.
So let's go back to your story. You said you suffered a little bit with a pornography addiction in your high school years and a little into your 20s. But you got that under control.
It's come back and forth throughout my life. Like, it's never truly been fully under control. I think it's something I've had to learn to cope with and include resources, like include my wife and include family and support systems to help me work through it.
And so battling with that, was that the only addiction that kind of ran in your family? Because now that you've worked for I Am Recovery and Reprieve, you've got to understand that a lot of this is genetics and a lot of this is passed down and it's a generational thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So both grandparents, the men grandparents, my grandpa and grandpa on both sides struggled with alcohol. My dad lost his father when he was just 3 years old from alcohol. Mm. And my mother had a absentee father. He was drinking all the time and ended up leaving the family high and dry. So she was raised mostly by her mom.
And so growing up with that kind of information, alcohol or drugs never really seemed to be a temptation?
I didn't find it as a temptation. I also had a really good family system. I had good friends, had good people in my neighborhood. I had 7 brothers and 1 sister. And that was rough at times, but they were all kind of on the same page. Like, we weren't going that direction.
Anyone in your family struggle with it?
I did have one brother who struggled with it. It was openly struggling I think I had another one maybe too. It was more hidden, but he struggled with it all through high school and he was really rebellious and the whole family was kind of turning against him. I was kind of a glue kid. I wanted to be part of his life. I always tried to put everyone together and be a peacemaker. Mm-hmm. The youngest of 9, I just kind of witnessed it all. And I was getting called into the family arguments to try to solve problems when I was 10 years old. So that was kind of a common piece in our family. And he inspired me, though, because he did go get clean and sober and totally pivoted his life. He became a social worker. And later in life, when I needed to get out of my own head and find some support, I found some information from him and went that direction.
So what kind of information, what were the kind of things that led you down this road? Because I think it takes a certain person, Dr. Matt, to get into social work, to get into therapy. Because I've said it so many times, like, your day is filled with every day people sharing their bad days.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah.
You know, and for you to help them kind of go through that information and make some sense and then point them in the right direction. I mean, some days you have some really heavy days.
Yeah, I think, I'd be curious to hear what you think, but I think especially with social work, it probably has a lot to do with personality styles of appreciating and enjoying that connection with other people, being very other-oriented, being a naturally empathic person who can kind of feel the struggles of others and also feel the joy of helping people. That's not to say if you have a different kind of career, you're not that way, but I think that would be fairly common amongst especially the social work crowd and not ever, caring about making $1 million. Cause as we know, yeah, people in mental health, we don't make a ton of money.
Yeah. For me, I was pretty miserable. You know, I was doing a lot of road sales. I was traveling to Canada, not being around my family very often. I had a lot of personal struggles with my relationship with my wife and parenting, just trying to figure out how to be a parent. You know, I look back to my own childhood and looking at how my parents raised me and how my family dynamic was. It was pretty disconnected in a lot of ways, and I didn't know what I was doing. And instead of doing the smart thing and hiring a therapist, I'm like, I'll go learn how to do all this stuff. So when my brother was happy and content and feeling fulfillment in his life coming home from work, and I was miserable and sad, and my marriage was falling apart, and my kids' relationships were really struggling, I thought, I got to figure this out. So I chose to go to school after, hitting rock bottom. You know, went through 2008 and bankrupted myself with all the real estate stuff. And I went through probably half a decade of depression, just feeling horrible.
So what you're talking about is similar to the rock bottom that an addict, finds himself in.
Yeah.
But you were emotionally, spiritual, and this kind of career rock bottom.
I was bottoming out in all those areas. My marriage was struggling. My family's health was struggling. Everything. Like, I'd kind of given up. Like, I didn't even file the bankruptcy paperwork for like 5 years. I was like, I'm just a loser at this point. I've got nothing left. Like, why even try? And that really stung. Like, I was noticing that my kids and I were disconnecting. My wife and I were disconnecting. My career was going nowhere in sales. It just felt unfulfilling. So it took a lot of that pain, like kind of what you're talking about earlier, to recognize that I just wanted something different.
So you find yourself wanting to be a social worker.
Yeah, it's weird. I've always been someone who people come to talk to for advice, and had always been a good connector with people. I just didn't have the tools. I didn't feel like I was the right person at that time. And my brother was like a model for growth. Like, he seemed the happiest, and he had been in the worst.
So you get your degree or certificate to be a social worker. And how long do you do social work for?
So I go to get my bachelor's degree, and I find out in Utah that doesn't do much. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a catch 22. I'm like, all right, I finished my bachelor's, like, I can't get any jobs.
And just so you know, a bachelor's degree in psychology is the same thing. You're not a psychologist. You can't really do much of anything.
Yeah.
So you have to go to graduate school. Yeah.
So I go get my graduate's degree, and I'm halfway through that program, and it's horrible. I mean, it's hard. It's good work, but it's really hard to manage a job. I've got 5 kids. I've got this school at night, and I'm about ready to be done. I was about ready to quit, and I go in the elevator to go to my school. That's the third floor, and the doors open, and I just don't get out. I'm like, I'm done. And my buddy, whose name was Paul, he was going through the program with me. He's like, are you coming? I'm like, nah, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. He's like, let's talk. So we rolled the elevator back down, and he talked to me for probably an hour. We missed class that night, and just kind of sat out there and went through all the things I was struggling with. And he's like, you can finish this. I'm like, okay. So with Paul's encouragement and my cohort, we had a good cohort of friends that went through the program together. I finished that level of schooling. And then I started doing the actual work, going to see family therapy. And I was blessed to be able to work with a lot of groups. During interning, I worked with people who are coming out of homelessness, people with all levels of mental health, children, adults, marriage, couples, everything. So I got kind of a sampler plate of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was really good, but nothing was kind of sticking. Like, nothing was kind of feeling right until I had an opportunity later to work with addiction recovery. And I ended up in a rehab facility. I was like, this is my people. It's my tribe. Like, the stories, the heart, the people coming in, it really connected with me. And I felt like I could help them. I felt like my self could really connect. And they were the most accepting, non-judgmental group of people.
Oh, I'll amen to that. I mean, it really is. I mean, you get in a room full of addicts and there is no judgment there. And it's an amazing feeling.
Well, and they'd fill me out, but honestly, like, I just love them. And by just loving them, they accepted me pretty quick. And it became my passion to help them. And where I was at, the place wasn't really interested in long-term solutions. But my mind is very ADD. I'm jumping all over and I'm seeing these solutions, seeing these things that could help people. And they just weren't available. They weren't available in abundance. So that's kind of where my mind started going that direction. Like, how do we really solve or really help long-term, not just 30 days, not just 45 days or whatever it was. And that's just kind of where my shift in focus went.
And so from there and that kind of information, what do you do?
Well, I was honestly just getting some pretty discouraged feelings. And I had approached some people about what we can do differently. And I was getting the same answers. Like, no, you know, there's ownership and then there's what happens on the ground. And
a lot of times those don't mesh.
They don't mesh. They don't always mesh. And I just kind of took a leap of faith. I found someone who was willing to bet on me, and we started I Am Recovery, and it was a massive uphill battle. You know, opening our first house, we had basically the equivalent of picketers, you know, people with their pitchforks ready to kill us. And, you know, we had lawsuits type stuff starting to happen and neighbors harassing my clients that were there. And it was like, do we really want to do this? There's so much opposition.
For the listeners, I mean, I think I know, but like in your experience, because you've been on the front lines, why do communities push back so hard on this?
I think it's a lack of understanding and education. People are people. You know, people see addiction sometimes as this black mark that they're going to steal from me, they're going to rob from me, they're going to hurt me. Mm-hmm. Why in my community? I mean, the neighbor at the one house said, well, I like what you're doing, but can you do it somewhere else?
You know, it reminds me of this comedy bit that George Carlin had. He was this wonderful comedian and very smart, and he came up with this acronym, and it's called NIMBY. And NIMBY means not in my backyard. He goes, everybody suffers from NIMBY. Mm-hmm. You can get a group full of people and go, hey, you know what we need? We need more prisons. And everyone's like, yes, we do. Yes, we do. We found this spot. Not there. Yeah. And nobody wants it in their backyard.
Right.
Like, people will want a recovery center. And it's hard to argue against having a recovery center.
Right.
Because you might know somebody or have a loved one that needs one. Yeah. But not here.
Yeah.
And so then where? But that's exactly where they need to be, because they're part of the community. They're part of the fabric. And we need to find them help.
There is that misunderstanding, like you said, lack of education. It's not a house where people are doing drugs. That's the other neighbor's mm-hmm. house. That's what's happening down the street.
And nobody's picking
that house. Nobody's picking that house because we're all pretending it's not happening. This is a house where people are healing, that no one is using drugs. People are struggling and they're getting healthy and better. So ironically, it doesn't make any sense to ignore the house where drugs are happening and to pick at the house where people are getting clean and sober. But I think that maybe put myself in, you know, the community of mental health providers, I think that is on us. We need to keep doing a better job of educating the public and making it more well known what's happening in these centers, because otherwise it'll always be NIMBY, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and to put it fairly, like a lot of the neighbors come around. Like after 6 months to a year, they start to recognize, like, there's no worst case scenarios happening. This is the driest house in the neighborhood. In fact, it's got a clean landscape. There's kind people. They're doing service in the community. They're going and cleaning up the parks. Like, yep. But usually after about a year, like, they want to help. Like, they kind of turn their attitudes around.
They
want to be part of it.
It comes a resource for the community. You mm-hmm. know, because once again, there's not a playbook out there. And so if you know somebody who's struggling, the neighbor might be go, you know, I don't have that answer, but there's this recovery center in my neighborhood. Let mm-hmm. me go knock on the door and talk to them and see if they can point me in the right direction.
Yeah. I love that, because most of us, our experience with addiction is negative. You know, most of us, we have a family member or a friend who is suffering or has passed away, who has been homeless or lost their jobs because of addiction. And so that's the only experience people have is with people who are struggling in active addiction. So it takes a while, and we don't really have too many opportunities because not enough of these places exist in our backyards to have the opposite experience, have the experience with knowing people that are getting clean and sober that are living in recovery, that you have people like social workers and other folks that are in your community helping, doing service. We need to help the communities have that experience with recovery, because all we can think if we haven't had that is our experience with addiction. And that is scary. You wouldn't want to have more addicts in your neighborhood, but you definitely want more people who are in recovery in your neighborhood.
Jared, let me ask you this. So you said you worked for a recovery center, and then you thought to yourself, there's some other tools and resources we need to give them a better chance in recovery. And that's what got you going to I Am Recovery. What were those extra things that you think that an addict needs to help them in recovery?
I think they need time and community, and they need jobs. They need to, get some longevity in recovery. Because that first year, 2 years, there's so many opportunities to fall backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the programs that are designed, they're only designed for like 30 days. So then you're saying, hey, good luck. You got 30 days under your hat. Now go make it 2 years. And it wasn't until one guy came in that was in recovery for about 2 years. He came into the center I was at, and his knuckles were tight, and he was speaking passionately about his work he was doing. And he was so energetic and wanting to do good, but he was still so nervous and anxious. And I sat down, I'm like, what's going on, man? And he's like, well, I spent all my money on the first 30 days. So the last couple of years, I've been doing this. I've been really white knuckling trying to make this work. And he's like, I wish I'd had a little more money to go across the whole couple years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I was like, we got to figure out a way to spread those resources out so that people actually have time and an opportunity to stay in recovery until their head clears, until they get some community and some friends that are all
in sober living or whatever it may be. And you think about it, most of the resources are put there for the first 30 days.
Right.
There were so many times that I was recovery when I was there, and I was there for 45 days, people would come in, and I saw multiple people come in and leave, and they'd be like, I'm here for 30 days. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's all I got. That's all I can afford. And that's all my work's going to give me. And everyone's like, well,
oof. It's like, good luck.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And so many people think just that 30 days is so important, which it is important. It's very important. But the real work starts the moment you leave.
Yeah. It starts with, it's the next stage. It's your family's getting educated. It's you getting good work around good people. It's changing your environments. It's getting a little money to pay off fines and bills and getting back on your feet. Like, there's so much to it, but it's so underdeveloped. And I feel like if there was more resources to spread it out, it would work better. But, insurance is only paid for the first chunk, and they don't pay a lot during the middle, and families are only so, they can only do so much. So there's problems to be solved. And I feel like if we move more towards communities, it'll be better. Like you were saying, Matt, like, engage the communities, get them involved, help people in their own neighborhoods know there's resources around them, so they don't have to go far away to get help. They can stay in their own community and get help and know that they're okay there.
So you're currently administration at I Am Recovery, and then you get a chance to move over to Reprieve Recovery. Walk me through that.
So administration I Am Recovery has been one of my dreams to get to the point where it's grown to the point it can self-sustain itself. But it's also really boring. I don't enjoy administration. It's not where my heart is. My heart is in group therapy. It's in counseling. It's going on hikes with clients. Reprieve gives me that opportunity. I went on a 6-hour hike yesterday, and it was incredible. And just getting to connect with clients again and being able to share one-on-one time. That's where my passion is. I didn't get into this to be a paper pusher. No offense to people who like that. I just don't. So getting an opportunity to work with people again is where I'm at.
Can I make a comment about that? Because you asked him earlier, what does a clinical director do? And so in any healthcare system, we have clinical directors or hospital administrators, people that are helping run the show so that the clinicians can do their jobs, right? So at the clinic I work at the University of Utah, we've been really lucky to have some fantastic clinic directors, and they make sure the lights are on and the bills are getting paid and the phones are getting answered and insurance and all of that, and they run all that so that those of us who provide care can sit there and work with patients and not have to be distracted with all of that. But I've found the very best clinical directors are people who love to be with the patients. And often, at least in my experience at the University of Utah, has been that a lot of our directors are social workers. a few psychologists, but mostly social workers. I don't know. Maybe we don't know. We can't handle all that math stuff. But the social workers do a great job. And my favorite ones are the ones that say exactly what you just said. They're like, you know, I want to, you know, sit in and spend some time with the patients. They're so busy, they don't usually have a lot of time to do it. But that's how I think a mark of a great clinic is, where you have the people who are in charge of the business end are also people that understand and love working in the healthcare side.
Thank you.
So now you're over at Reprieve, and for those who don't know, it just opened up. It's an 8-person bed in Morgan, Utah, a little small community where you had some problems.
It's really the best community in Utah. I don't know if people are aware of
that. Don't tell anyone that.
Yeah. But you had some problems getting it started there, and now you're up and running. What does Reprieve look like? I know it's a women-only facility. 8 beds. A lot of times when you're picking a recovery center, and people reach out to me and ask the best ones in the state, and I will give them my advice, but I always tell people, you got to find out if it's a fit for you, mm-hmm. what modalities they are using. And when I say modalities, it's like, is it mindfulness? Is it 12-step? Is it spiritual? Whatever it may be, mm-hmm. you've got to figure out if that is. So how would you tell people what Reprieve is about?
Yeah, I think you kind of nailed that one. It's definitely spiritual. I work with John Redd and Ryan Brown, and they're high spirit guys. They're also high 12-step guys. I'm big on spirituality. That's one of the core focuses. I try to help my clients find theirs, whatever that looks like. And this place is just beautiful. Like, we're on a mountain. We've got the whole valley view. We have this massive willow tree that it just exuberates light and love. It's a great healing environment. So, if, you know, adult women who have been traumatized, struggle with addiction, mental health, it doesn't matter. It's a place to kind of really rest. And that's why John named it Reprieve. It's a place to take a break from the world and get yourself healed and healing.
I love it. And so you got therapists there. You go on hikes. And maybe this is a good time to talk about what goes on in a recovery center. Because I don't think a lot of people know. You know what I mean? They go for 30 days and they come back.
I think some people might be afraid to go because they don't know what to expect.
Well, I think, and we've talked about this early on when we started the podcast 4 years ago, when I thought I was going to treatment in a recovery center, I thought I was going to a room with 2 single beds in it. All the walls were white. They were concrete.
Nurse Ratchet was going to come get you for your pills.
Yeah. And just the things you saw on TV. I was pleasantly surprised when I moved into a beautiful house with wonderful furnishings, a wonderful kitchen, an ice maker. They talk about the ice maker all the time because it was one of the selling points. It had that the crunchy ice.
Yeah, I know.
But it was. And but then you're spent your day in process groups.
Well, let's pause on that for a second, though. The environment makes all the difference. And so that's a beautiful example of misinformation, mm-hmm. that is the mentality or the stereotype that most Americans have about mental health care in general, is that it is sterile, white walls. A lot of it really does come from the popularity of that movie, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or Girl Interrupted, that book and movie, and where it's promoting this. And to be honest, in the old days, but we're talking 70, 80 years ago, because of being underfunded and all of those sorts of things, mental health in its infancy did maybe look like that in some places. It no longer looks like that. Huntsman Mental Health Center doesn't look like that. Our beautiful clinic downtown in Salt Lake doesn't look like that. And a quality recovery center feels like a home. Mm-hmm. And I am biased because Morgan is the greatest community in Utah.
Hey, stop saying that, huh?
But I know, but don't move there. There's no more spots.
Morgan's going to run me out of town.
Yeah. We don't need ski resorts, but we do want another recovery center. But it is a beautiful healing place. I was up there last weekend. I'm going to be up there this weekend. I love being there. And the house itself creates a healing environment. A few years back, it was very popular to talk about feng shui, right? Mm-hmm. But that's a real concept, which talks about the organization and beauty of your environment does have a direct impact on your mental and emotional health. And so folks who run these recovery centers do put a lot of thought into making this a healing, beautiful environment. If you're in a healing, beautiful environment that's organized and clean and conducive to healing, then all of the modalities can make a difference, but you try to take those same modalities and put it into a chaotic, unpleasing environment, and it's not going to have the same effect.
What does an average day look like at Reprieve Recovery?
So it looks like, you know, you start out with some exercise, you start out with some set grounding, centering, setting an intention for your day, and then getting fed well, good food, and then getting a chance to do some process group or an experiential activity, like going hiking and experiencing the mountains and nature and doing some meditative work. And then after a good lunch, it's more group, more connection. We have a lot of healthy staff, you know, that are willing to sit down and talk to anybody and work with them. And we might wrap the night up with going to an AA meeting or a meeting similar to that. We're looking at like getting other meetings involved that are in the
Narcotics
area.
Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous.
Yeah, any of them, you name it.
I remember when, I was in for alcohol, but we went to a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And I was like, these guys are my people. They were fun. They were flippant. And they were loud. I remember I looked at the guy next to me who was, you know, a regular. And I was like, hey, do you have to be into cocaine to be in this meeting? He's like, no, you don't. He was, you just have to be willing to be so sober. And I was like, I got it. I go, you guys are my people. Mm-hmm. I like you guys.
I love the NA people.
Yeah, yeah. And once again, every home group, every, you know, support group is going to have a different feel. Mm-hmm. You've got to find one that matches your personality.
Goodness of fit.
Yeah, good fit.
Well, one thing I tell you, we're non-punitive. Like, we're always going to be looking for a positive reinforcement or solution, trying to help people uplift and see what their thoughts are doing and change them to more of a positive outlook. And that's something that I've learned over the years is there's two types of programs. There's the bully. We're going to bully you or we're going to love you. We're definitely on the love you spectrum, especially with John Red. Like, he's going to hug you 100 times and love you. And our clients are going to get a chance to feel that. And they do get to feel that.
I think this would be a good time to talk about the resource that recovery centers can provide. Because when I got out of recovery and I worked for Pinnacle Recovery and I was a recruitment person for them, marketer is what they called it. And I would go out in the community and be a resource and hopefully help people find recovery. My ultimate job was to get people in our house. But I would find people that weren't a fit for our house. One, they didn't have the money, they didn't have the insurance, or they just weren't a good fit for the house. But what I did do is if I couldn't help them, I had a group of people that I could go, you know what, you might fit better in this house. This house actually takes your insurance and this. And so if you are struggling with addiction or you have a loved one struggling with addiction, it would be a benefit to you to call just any of these houses and say, hey, look, I'm struggling. What can I do or where
and
can I go?
So you brought up a good point earlier, Casey, that, you know, it's these recovery centers are, you know, there's a service oriented goal. We want to serve the community, mm-hmm. help people get well. But it's also a business mm-hmm. and they have to keep the lights on. But here's a significant difference between this and the other businesses. If you called up Home Depot and you were like, hey, I need this stuff. And they're like, well, we don't have it. I don't think they're really going to go out of their way to find another.
Did you check
Lowe's? Yeah, let me call Ace for you and see what they have. Like, they're not invested in helping you. So it's not a business like other businesses. This is a business where I would say 99% of the time, the person that's answering that phone really cares. And if you are struggling and don't know what resources would be a good fit for you or your loved one, I agree with you, Casey. You can call up almost any of them and ask. And if they don't have it, they are almost always willing to go out of their way to help you find it.
Yeah, my only tip of advice on that is don't go off of the top searches on Google, because a lot of those sites are paying buku bucks to get the leads and they're not as community driven.
Yeah.
I find that if you're willing to do a little research, call a few of them, a lot of them play really nice with each other and they really do want to help. Like guys like Ryan Hymas, he'll get you into the right fit every time. Like, that's his goal. He doesn't care if they go to Iron Recovery or anywhere else. He cares if they go to the right place for them. And John Red's the same way. And there's a lot of guys like John and Ryan out there, and they're doing it for their heart. And Ryan told me this. He's like, in every facility, there are good people working there. Mm-hmm. There are good people in every facility. They're not all owned by the best people. There's going to be politics in any environment.
So would you say, like, if we could identify locally owned and run, would
that's
make a difference?
That's generally going to be good. And in my own personal opinion, is less hospital feeling type stuff, like more like mom and pop style. The bigger they get, they tend to get more cold, in my opinion.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I personally like to work with more of the smaller shops.
Do you guys mind if people call you and ask those kind of questions?
Oh, I love it when people call me. Like, that's been our goal from the beginning, is if someone calls us, we just want to get them the right fit and help them get to where they need to go. And I've learned that in the industry is it's a good human thing to do, but I've also learned which facilities do that well, mm-hmm. and that's their same kind of goal. And they play nice in the sandbox together. You know, they help each other out in making sure people get their best services.
I think that a lot of times in the world, there's a scarcity mentality. Like if I give to someone else, I'm not going to have enough. And so a lot of businesses or individual people, you have to think about it yourself. Do I have a scarcity mentality? Or do I sort of have an abundance mentality? Do I believe that the more I give, then the more is going to be available for me and everyone else? And I actually really believe in that. I believe in it on pretty much all levels of life, but especially in healthcare and especially in recovery. It's an abundance mentality. If you're out there and you can call it karma, you can call it whatever you want. I just think that's actually how life functions. When we don't shut down, when we open up, then we have more coming both ways. And so for you guys, when people call up and you send them somewhere else, I assume you believe that as well, that
absolutely
your beds are going to be full because you're helping other people's beds be full.
No, we're big abundance guys, big abundance, blue ocean. Like there's no competition. There's 50 million people in America already struggling with addiction, are not getting services at least.
Yeah.
It's not like there isn't 50 million people who need help. Yeah. So there's no competition.
Right.
So what do you want for the future of Reprieve?
I want it to be a healing place for women that can also transition down to the other levels of care. I want people to go there and stay in recovery. That's the biggest thing that sucks in this industry is when someone doesn't stay or when they die, obviously. But we know relapses happen, but the more they happen, the more it kind of wears on you. And my whole goal has been to help people stay in it so they can give back to society. There's very few instances where you see people give more than someone who's in recovery. They have lost it all and they want to give it all. And that's like the way they live. They're the people who save society. They're the ones who are bringing the society back from the brink.
So how is everything in your life personally now that you kind of went on this spiritual journey?
It's as best as it's ever been, Casey. Like I've had a lot of trials, you know, I'll call them like personal problems, struggles, family problems, a lot of family health, I could go into that, but I won't. But it's all kind of been a matter of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only miracle I ever really needed was perspective. And when I finally came around to that, my life is great. I love my family. I love my life. I love what I do. And it's exactly as it should be.
You know, this was a fun podcast because we touched on all kinds of aspects of recovery. And this was coming from a guy who had not really suffered of addiction, but wanted to give back and thought he could make a difference and make a connection. And the world needs more people like that. And I just think it's amazing.
And that's why I really advocate for all of us from government level on down to the individual person, seeing the value of recovery for our communities. It's for the individual. That's the person in there getting help. But then that person turns around and does exponential good. And I didn't know that before I got the chance to be a co-host on this show. And I know it now. And I'm so grateful that I have the opportunity to talk to people like you that are doing that work every day. And I love that it's happening in my hometown. I'm proud of that. And I really love the chance to sit down and talk about all the good that people in recovery do.
Ryan, Jared, for people who want more information about Reprieve, where do they go?
ReprieveRC.com. And they can also call admissions line, which I don't have the number.
We'll put it down there below.
I bet it's on the website, though.
Yes, it is.
There you go.
And thank you for stopping by and sharing your story, man. It was amazing. A lot of information. And I think this will be a wonderful podcast.
I agree with you, Casey. I believe it. I think it's already a wonderful podcast.
You know what? I can sense both of you guys' sarcasm.
Well, thank you for having me. You guys are a joy. Really.
No, we love you, buddy. Thank you very much. And thank you for stopping by and listening to another episode of Project Recovery. And in case you forgot, Project Recovery is what?
It's a KSL podcast.
Nothing changes.
Nothing changes.
That's a meme.
That is a meme.
The contents of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.